We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens. What kind of radio show is this?
Okay, well, I'm going to pivot to a different topic here because I love this stuff. I feel like I could talk to you all day on a whole bunch of different stuff, I feel. So it's like we want to cover as much as we can in a sense. And there was one thing that jumped out at me in the book because I've been kind of – I kind of fancy myself like a sociologist of this field, of these fields, John. You know, I sort of study the groups that are studying, if you will. And I've been really fascinated by – I hope this doesn't raise your blood pressure, by these targeted individuals, quote unquote. And you talk about it because I find it really hard to believe. And so I was relieved when I got to the part in the book where you talk about it and you pretty much, you know, you're not a fan, let's say, of the targeted individuals conspiracy, I guess you'd call it. I don't know. It's really weird. So I figure, you know, we rarely talk about it on here because I'm like, it's like flat earth or something, man. But you know, yeah, as a guy who's clearly well versed in the world of non-lethal weaponry, you sort of, you know, I see how you sometimes I don't know, you know, you'd be the one to ask, I guess. So you know, what is with this craziness?
I lost the question in there.
what do you make of this targeted individual thing?
What do you want me to address?
the whole like quote unquote phenomenon. Because in the book, you're like you say that, you know, it's unlikely. It's hard to believe. It's fantasy.
Again, which it?
Targeted the whole idea of targeting people who are like harassed by the government and sort of like with electronic.
You're talking about TIs.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
I forgot. Yeah, I guess I should have used the acronym.
Thing on targeted individuals. Well, it's interesting that we've been at a number of conferences. I haven't been back for a few years, but biannually they were having a conference at Etlin in Germany on the European work on non-lethal weapons, and I was picketed there. In fact, they came out with the Polizei armed guards for the conference because it does bring out particularly crazies. It's actually a terribly complex issue. I think some of them certainly believe that certain events are happening to them and that the government is involved. What is not well understood is the level of paranoia and schizophrenia that are, you know, in the standard population. Low estimates, are like around 2%. So when you extrapolate that in the U.S. to, you know, what, 320 million, we're talking about millions of folks out
there.
That's
a lot of people.
Seriously disturbed.
Yeah.
And paranoia, as we know, is that people think that things are after them. Now, there was kind of a related phenomenon called My Labs, is getting into the UFO arena. People who believe that they have been abducted by military personnel and examined and that they're running it. Unfortunately, one of the key individuals who was offering this idea was literally with the Austrian equivalent of our NASA. He was an astrophysicist. And I frankly took him to task because there are several aspects to that, and that is, how would you do that? I mean, you end up with some vast number of people, and if they believe the government's involved in it, and if you go to understand that this has been around for decades, that a lot of it predates certainly the establishment of the satellite constellations that are out there that now, I mean, people are very familiar with GPS. I imagine some of your young listeners probably don't even remember a time when it wasn't around, but
yeah.
In the old days, we actually had to read maps and things like to get around.
Yeah.
And so if you say, you start looking at the number of people who would be necessary to accomplish the kinds of things, I mean, the numbers are just overwhelming.
Yeah.
And so I also had pointed out, I think I did this in UFOs, Myths, Conspiracies, and Realities, and talked about, you know, if you did that, it would be exceedingly high risk from an institutional perspective, because if you got caught, I mean, obviously it would be patently illegal, and I'm familiar with some of the, you know, very high-profile cases that make these assertions, and I do not support them, but as I've told, one individual, some may know, just said, if what he told me is true, he belongs in jail. You know, if they were harassing civilians for whatever purposes.
Yeah.
And yet, like I say, you have a substantial number of people who believe these sorts of things are happening to them. And I think in most of the cases, a straight medical diagnosis, and I get emails from such individuals from time to time, and I usually respond by saying, you know, ethically, I think I must tell you to seek competent psychiatric assistance. Don't appreciate that, but I really think that that's, you know, more likely to explain what's going on. Now, if you want to get into abductions and some of the other things, we can address that, which I think is a little bit different. So,
how do you think?
Where would you like to go?
Well, you sort of from the way you said that, it sounds like that's something you'd like to segue into. So that's fine with me. Let's keep rolling. So, what do you think's going on with the abduction phenomenon? Because it's from an outsider perspective looking at it, to me it's just interesting that it was so exploded in such renown or whatever you want to call it, infamy or whatever, got burst into the zeitgeist, you know, in the 1980s. But now it's just sort of like, I know there's some abduction researchers out there, but it's like seems to have come to quite a fizzled out, if you will. So to me, it's like, I find that interesting. But what do you think about the phenomenon itself?
It depends on to whom you speak. But, you know, at its peak, I used to say, well, if this is ET, you know, coming here on UFOs and doing this, what we have is an airspace management problem. You know, where are you parking all these crap?
Right, yeah. That's
it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I recall a similar argument from Jacques Vallée, where it's like, if all the people they think were being abducted were, like, the sky would be teeming with UFOs. You wouldn't even need to, you know, you wouldn't need to be looking for sightings, because you just look up like you see a plane.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I also point out, however, that there are reports of contact between humans and sentient non-human entities that have been going on throughout the entirety of human history.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that you find these in all cultures and reports of them. And of course, they vary considerably. Again, having spent a lot of time in Hawaii, the Menahune were, you know, kind of what was there. But the wee folk in various places, fairies, and then you have giants and, you know, this wide variety of entities. But what's of interest is that, again, ubiquitous, and it appears in all cultures in various forms and whatnot, that these folks arrived in little metal craft and things is actually generally a fairly new wrinkle on it. And this gets back to the, you know, one of our early statements, and what is the impact of human consciousness, and how does that interact with these sorts of things? And I happen to think that, A, we don't understand it, but B, it is a critical component to whatever it is going on. And let me give you a specific example. This guy is now known. When I first heard of this particular case, he had not become visible because he was extremely high level in the intelligence community, very straightforward. And what happened was he's not quite sure, I think it's around 91, he's living in Northern Virginia and wakes up, and here are three uniformed entities standing next to his bed. And these are not military uniforms as we know them, but, you know, he still said they were uniform. And then something happens, and the next thing they know, they wake up. He and his wife wake up, and they're outside. And whatever it was they were wearing to bed that night, and scared to death. Obviously, a fair amount of time, you know, had passed.
Yeah.
And said, you know, we got to get inside before they come back and whatnot. In this particular case, there's a number of physical attributes that had taken place. So you had something that was quantifiable. And there was a hole in the back of his neck. They more recently had some fMRIs done, and it looks like something is there's a vacancy somewhere in the center of the brain area.
Yikes.
The point is, we've heard many, many stories like this, but it was really unusual when you find somebody with these kind of credentials saying, yeah, it happened to me, too, and has, you know, to this day has no idea of what it was. His wife, similarly, who does not have the recollection that he does at a conscious level, but had a number of physical symptoms, including vaginal bleeding and some of those things that believed to be directly related to whatever the experience was.
Strange. Yeah. Well, I think part of what I meant in a sense of how you don't see it as much is like, you know, with John Mack gone and Bud Hopkins gone and David Jacobs kind of receding from the spotlight, it's like the big three of abductions. There's really no one to sort of like carry the banner for it either. It's just kind of interesting.
John was a personal friend, and we had discussed these things. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is that, you know, he and I would agree, I think, quite strongly in the complexity of these issues, and that it's just not simple, you know, little gray guys from Zeta Reticuli come up and, you know, zap you, or reptilians, or, you know, pick your entity.
Yeah.
And one of the things that bothers me in the descriptions that have taken place globally, where you have certain things that are description of entities that take place in certain areas that seem to have a geographical location to it. And you go, no, wait a minute. You want me to believe that these guys have crossed the universe, you know, and they have the capability to do that, and then they have carved out territory here on Earth? You know, just defies common sense.
Yeah. What do you think of, and I know it came up in the book, I think it was in the Skinwalker chapter, but I've had a person on the show who had a personal experience with a portal, and as I said, in the Skinwalker book, you mentioned a portal story. What are your thoughts on portals in general? Like, have you sort of had any experiences with that phenomenon, and have you looked at sort of that phenomenon? Because I feel like it's kind of like, I feel like it's on the cusp of being sort of an interesting thing that starts bubbling up more and more going forward.
Yeah. Well, as I point out in the book, I was with Bob the day that he actually bought the ranch, and alone spent that night on the ridgeline overlooking the I mentioned Skinwalker Ranch is just pretty much perfectly flat, And then to the north was an escarpment that rose a couple of hundred feet up on the top of the mason. So I was sitting up there where he could observe what was going on, and which nothing of particular interest came to me. But more to your point, it does appear that there are certain areas that, you know, colloquially have been called portals, but certainly areas of intense psychic phenomena. And,
yeah,
of course, what happened at the ranch, we had, you know, a wide variety of those.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, of course, Sedona comes to mind as an area that people talk about. Rapa Nui, or also known as Easter Island, is one where things happen. And there do seem to be a number of places around the world. I've done some work in Europe as well and been told about places over there that are very similar to this but tend to be more locally known.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's, like I said, it's, I feel like I'm hearing more stories, let's put it that way, about portals lately than I have in a long time, if ever. So it's like, to me, I think, who knows, maybe there's a maybe there's a loosening between the two sides,
you know,
or something.
Yeah, I gave you my Jesse Ventura story that's related to that. He was here.
Yeah, that's a weird story. Yeah, yeah. Please do. That's, I remember that story from the book, and I was like, what a dick.
Well, they were here filming for a program called Conspiracy Theory. And if I might digress, one of the things I really objected to was a different episode in which they were dealing with targeted individuals, and I thought really taking advantage of some very troubled people in a way that's unethical. But anyway, Ventura was here, and I had been contacted before they came. Ostensibly, the topic was to be civilians in space. And that made sense because we've talked about Bob Bigelow. Of course, by that time, he had Bigelow Aerospace. Bert Rutan was also a personal friend. I mentioned Bert in my UFO book. Bert actually provided a foreword for it. I'd actually asked him for a blurb, you know, good stuff, read the book. Instead, he came back and laid out his own personal sighting. And people don't know, Bert is one of the premier aviators in the entire world. And so you can't say he really doesn't understand, you know, what he was seeing there. So anyway, that made sense, and they sent me a list of questions. And it was all about space. And I had been there when Bert had put Mike Melville into space the first time in a civilian, totally civilian enterprise had put a civilian into. So that was me. And we talked for a couple of hours and did the interview. And some people who have complained, they said they noticed that it was like I was trying to get away. Now, what had happened was the interview was over, and I was actually starting to get up to take the little microphone pack off the back of my belt.
Yeah.
And an idiot from the sideline goes, "What about Skinwalker Ranch?" And I said, "I thought we agreed not to talk about that." And that was obviously one of the phrases that they actually ended up using, because it turns out the whole thing was an ambush to talk about the ranch. But one of the things that, you know, he had asked me about was, you know, could I get him on the ranch? No. And I said, besides, you'd be really bored. And this gets to the main story here.
Yeah.
And the portal issue. It is not as if something happens every day. If you sit there and, you know, at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, the UFOs appear or something like that. There were a number of very, very strange these highly dramatic instances that took place. But when you amortize that, you know, over the 6 years that we were there, and, you know, things that went on with Terry before that, you know, it's just, you know, it's totally unpredictable.
Right, right.
And in, I don't know if I did it in this book, I did in UFOs, when I talked about, I came up with a concept of precognitive sentient phenomena.
Right, yes, that's in my notes to talk to you about, yeah. So, good man.
And I had mentioned this to him, and I said, it seems like there was some entity, some sentient thing that was in control. Now, sometimes it's called the Trickster or Coca-Cola, or, you know, has a bunch of names. Again, appears in folklore around the world. But the point was that it, A, was in charge. No doubt about who's in charge. And would present us with various phenomena. And it seemed to know how we would respond to the phenomena before we had even encountered it. And thus it was precognitive in the way that it knew what we were going to do before we did it, sentient, clearly intelligent, and phenomena beyond belief. I mean, we had just, and, you know, the whole first chapter of the book has to do with some of the things that have happened there. I also recommend the book by George Knapp and Colm Kelleher,
oh, yeah.
Search for the Skinwalker, which has it in more detail.
Yeah, it's a great book.
But, you know, again, a portal, did it happen? Absolutely. Nightly? Nope.
Right, right.
Predictably?
Yeah.
Nope. You know, frustrating? Absolutely.
Yeah, that's, yeah, that could be... That could be like a, that could be a plot for like an Oscar-winning movie. Somebody like on a ranch like that sees a portal, and then they spend the rest of their life waiting for the portal to open again. And maybe right before they die, the portal does. So, there you go. We just wrote an Oscar-winning movie here tonight on the show, John. Give that to Victoria. Maybe she can get it made. It's much like a lot of the phenomenon, at least as far as like... not the psi ability, but like the UFO phenomenon. We're generally at the mercy of the phenomenon itself. You know, doesn't seem like there's much we can do to really conjure it.
Well, that's an excellent example because, you know, when we talk about UFOs, we talk about generally these phenomenal cases. And I put Bentwaters kind of at the top of my list there, but the Phoenix Lights. And there's a whole series of things. It, certainly what happened with the fated giant where the missiles got taken offline here, Soviet having similar kinds of instances that happened. Very, very dramatic. But you pile them up, you know, on top of each other, and it's like, wow, you know, this is happening, you know, we'll go out tonight and this will happen. When you recognize that, you know, you spread that over, you know, at least 70 years, not longer, and over a globe, and they're actually fairly rare occurrences. Having said that, because of the ubiquitous availability of you know, cell phones and as well as just normal surveillance videos that are being taken. I was doing a talk recently and somebody said, you know, well, why aren't these happening now? I said, well, reality is they're coming in almost daily, and you look on the net or something like Filer's Files that has a pretty good repertoire on them. And, yeah, they are continuing, and it is happening. But it is in charge.
Yeah. It's like you're right about that. I've heard that argument, too, from people where it's like, well, there's all these cell phones everywhere. It's like this, yeah, and there's all these UFO videos everywhere if you go on YouTube. Like, if there isn't a dearth of UFO videos, trust me, there's tons of them. Most of them are pretty lousy, but, you know.
it is, but you got to remember that when these things happen, it's usually kind of by surprise.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Somebody has to have the camera where they can get it and ready. There's another case that I talked about, a guy that I knew who was a actually retired Air Force working down at Kirtland Air Force Base living in Albuquerque, interested in the topic. And so one Saturday afternoon, he's out working in his garage. It's open, and he looks up, and here's a UFO, rather unique design, just hovering there and periodically covered by clouds. And he watched it for a while and let it go. And this went on for about an hour and a half. But he then said, you know, I had a camera with film sitting in the garage, and I never thought to go pick it up and take a photograph.
Right, right.
And I can't explain that.
Yeah, that seems to be, that is a frequent factor in a lot of these events, and it seems like it's not a coincidence, obviously. And it's like, yep. To me, it seems like it might be, it's produced almost maybe by the phenomenon. Where it's like it, or I guess in a sense by the person seeing it too, where it's like you're so enamored with what you're experiencing that to look away for even a second is unthinkable.
But it is in control.
Yeah. Now tell me about your ayahuasca experience, because that's kind of one of my bucket list experiences that I'd like to have. So anytime I get a chance to talk to somebody who's done it, I'd like to know more about it.
Yeah, we can certainly help you out there. I've dealt with shamans in many places. Ayahuasca, for those not familiar with it, this is a brew that is made in Amazon. What you have to do is take at least two disparate vines and you put them together and cook them. And it provides something that the shamans use to contact spirits. We do know that DMT or dimethyltryptamine is supposedly the psychoactive substance that's in there. Though I will tell you, my observation is that psychopharmacology does not explain the range of effects that I've personally observed.
Mm-hmm.
We have one shaman in particular, Ron Wheelock, who is known as the Gringo Shaman down in Iquitos. And I certainly recommend, if anybody's interested, that he's a guy to go to. One of the key aspects of imbibing is knowing your shaman.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's not a lot of quality control.
Yeah.
And shamans have their own recipes and whatnot. Interestingly, many of the indigenous shamans go to Ron to get their material.
Interesting.
What happens is this is a quasi-religious ceremony normally with the shamans in this area, and most of the ones I've been involved in. It looks a lot like fundamentalist Catholic, and that has a lot to do with the area. The Catholic priests were the ones who did a lot of the civilizing of the of this area.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the initial ceremony, lots of smoke involved usually, and this has to do with, it's like smudging, protecting psychically the area that you're going to be operating in. The individuals then are called up and they're given a cup. And what happens is the shaman intuits how much material every particular individual gets. And it is god-awful.
Yeah, I've heard that, yeah.
The hardest part, frankly, is getting it down. You do not want to sip it. I've had very little encounter. My wife is a devotee and has been using this for years and has had many mystical experiences, and she literally has another world that she goes to and is recognized. And I might mention that in the Amazon, the shamans address this as the medicine, and they really do see medicinal purposes to it. And also there's a number of different types of ayahuasca and used for different reasons, healing being one of those, visions being one, prognostication another. So you take this, and then the shamans begin their ikaros. And the ikaros are songs or chants, and according to the traditions that I'm aware of, is that as they become initiates, they're usually trained for an extended period of time with a senior shaman, that they are given, and I mean this is more like divination, psychically given the ikaros that they are going to chant. And they do this for hours, and it's absolutely amazing. I have quite a bit on tape. Since I rarely drank, I was usually assigned the task of being the one who was controlling, and it was tape recorder in those days, to listen to this thing and the melody. And it also literally creates a field effect. I've had experiences just being in the vicinity of, the ceremonies that are going on and not having had any of the material to drink. Again, responses vary. I do recommend Rick Strassman's book, if anybody's going to look at this. One is the DMT, the Spirit Molecule, because this is, I might mention Rick was an MD working at the University of New Mexico and was specifically authorized to experiment with the substance. There's very little, controlled experimentation has been done. Again, most of this is, out in the jungle.
Right, right.
And so, again, he has the books that do this. I'm trying to...
Did you... Oh, go ahead.
Huh?
You started breaking up on me there, I think.
No, the... So anyway, so you have, that aspect to it. Now, I would also mention we have done it in Ecuador, in Peru. In Peru, we engaged in Santo Daime. Are you familiar with that?
No. Tell me about that.
That's actually a religion. And... so this is, it was one of the fastest growing religions in the area, and they use some ayahuasca. Victoria said it's really quite weak by comparison to what we've done with Ron. And there's also there a lot of movement with the shamans we've dealt with in Peru and Ecuador. It's usually pretty dark most of the time. It's usually just kind of a small light available. And there's also attendance. Now, one of the things I should mention, people worry about, ayahuasca will never become a recreational drug because there are side effects that are quite dramatic. And you go through a process of purging, so regurgitation is kind of happening consistently, but a fair number of people start running at the other end, and there's some natives who are available to get you to the outhouses.
Yikes.
One of the things I just brought up that I want to quote, because I had talked about Strassman's book, and as you know, again, he was doing this in a laboratory under controlled conditions. And the quote was, "We enter into invisible realms, ones we cannot normally sense and whose presence we can scarcely imagine. Even more surprising, these realms seem to be inhabited."
Yeah. That's the, yes, exactly. I mean, I think that's why everybody's so, or people who are familiar with this are so tantalized by the whole idea.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, this is not for the timid.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, I mean, what you're saying about the side effects, yeah, I've heard these similar stories that it's just it's a grueling experience.
Yeah. No, like I say, you... It's everybody has their bowl when you're sitting there around in the dark and whatnot. But I was thinking more of the psychological impacts as well.
Yeah.
It can be terrifying. Now, what's interesting is I've again sat in on many ceremonies. I have seen people just literally terrified, screaming, yelling for their mother, and you know, all of these sorts of things. But the next morning they go, "Wow, that was just what I needed." And that's another aspect of it is there's usually no hangover. I'd say these ceremonies usually ran till 3 o'clock or so in the morning. And the biggest thing is people would tend to sleep late. When we worked with some of the shamans in indigenous shamans in Peru, then they usually followed up with the next day. They would do a bathing with a special flower water, and again repeating the acaros as part of the ceremony. I should mention when we first were working again with indigenous shamans in Iquitos, or not actually, we were out in the jungle in the general area there. As they were creating the brew, you know, they would chant the acaros, and the point is that putting intention into the material as it was being developed.
Ah, I see, yeah.
One of the interesting, I asked Hamana Mari, which was on the shamanic world, he said, "How did you ever come up with this? You know, why would people take these disparate substances, put them together, and cook them and all of that?"
Yeah, it's an interesting question, yeah.
Her response was, "The plants told us to."
Interesting.
And, you know, there are lots of... various kinds of plant healings that have come out of there. In fact, biopiracy, if you want to discuss that, but that's been one of the key issues where Big Pharma has sent anthropologists in and they find out what the shamans are doing, collect the samples, bring it out, synthesize it, and they make huge profit, and the indigenous people get screwed.
Yeah, I saw you. I learned about that from your book. I was like, "Wow, that's crazy! I never even thought of that." Yeah.
Yeah, it is a huge, ethical problem. But it's interesting. Again, program that I just talked about here. Somebody they were complaining about, people not knowing, indigenous folks not knowing anything. And there are many areas where, they can teach us quite a bit. And one of the things that, unfortunately, Hamana Mari has transitioned herself recently, but, said, just ask. We can work with the plants, and they will tell us what we need to do to create cures for these various illnesses.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, when you were on the ayahuasca, did you encounter any entities or anything? I know your wife has, but have you encountered any? Tell me a little bit about your wife's experience.
It was extremely colorful. We do anticipate that James Cameron has, if you remember his movies and, the brilliant colors that are in there, and some of them, quite frankly, are colors that do not exist in consensus reality. Very, very difficult to describe.
Yeah, interesting.
I'm a control freak, and I acknowledge that. So I don't like this notion of just letting go and whatnot. So it's problematic. One of the things I do recommend in this area, and it's sort of emerging, though, is for using ayahuasca in some areas of treating PTSD. And many people are finding that quite useful. Again, not for the timid, not the first stop, but have had quite a bit of success because the people go out and have these psychical confrontational experiences and frequently lead to a deeper understanding of what is causing the psychic trauma.
Yeah. Interesting. So tell me about the entities, though. I understand your wife encountering. So what are these beings like, and what do they have to say?
I don't know. It's interesting. We do not discuss those things. And she will often take months to process it. And, one of the first experiences we had down there, and I didn't find out until some time later, that she had an experience of basically encountering God. And just says, A, happened, B, no, we're not discussing it. A very personally intense emotional experience. She does believe in the goddess or mother ayahuasca and believes that people are called to it. It is not something one wants to do frequently unless you're the shaman, because the shamans do drink a small amount and they go along on the journey with you. We had talked about John Mack, and when John was here, we were discussing it, and he said he had four experiences. It had been several years before that, but it took that much time to process and integrate the experience. So it's not like people from the outside tend to run, I want to have, I'm going to be there for a week, so I want five ceremonies.
Oh, Jesus.
No, you have no idea what you're talking about.
That's crazy. All right, fair enough. That I hear where you're coming from. Now, I guess the last sort of big point I want to talk to you about before we wrap things up was, and I feel like we've kind of like put together a lot of the disparate pieces of that over the course of this conversation tonight. And this your what you call the step back concept, which I really like a lot. But I guess my question, and then I'll sort of give a thumbnail and you can delve more into it, which is sort of like we need to take a step back, look at all the information we have in sort of an unbiased sort of just a blank slate, if you will, and sort of just take all the information and then try and sort of synthesize it. Possibly using like human machine learning and AI and that kind of stuff, hopefully in the future, and find some kind of like patterns that aren't there initially. Correct? That's sort of the idea.
Yeah, this is a concept I came up with a number of years ago. I have offered it in several places. Unfortunately, I have never found anybody who was willing to fund it.
Yeah, I guess that's the question I had for you in a sense. Who's the we? Who do you think should be doing this, though?
Well, it has not happened. And let me describe the process a little bit more. What I suggested was that we get a number of people who have had broad experiences, maybe myself, where you enter the field and say, we're going to get together sequestered, i.e. they're going to live together for probably 3 days or something like that, and do what we used to call monstergrams, and maybe it can be done on computers now, I'm not sure. But the point is to have people explain or describe their observations without putting values on it, i.e. it's not a UFO, it's not a poltergeist, it's something. It's, you describe, I've got balls of light or all the various things, and you just describe the observation without saying what it is. I'll give you a specific example where I had encountered this. I mentioned I was the president of the International Association for Near-Death Studies for a long time, and I answered a lot of mail. And I would frequently get letters saying, well, I wasn't close to death, but, and it would describe out-of-body states, interaction with entities, blah, 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 things that sounded very much like classic NDEs. So the point and the step back is you would do this, but on a much broader scale, and again, bring in people who have had experiences in many, many phenomena, and take the first amount of time, and you'd actually put this on a board. The reason I like the monstergram as opposed to computer, but this is where you can actually see these things. And once you've got all of these observations down, then physically step back, look at that, and begin macro pattern analysis.
Yeah.
Say, okay, how do these things fit together? What aspects are, where are we seeing commonalities? And then from that, you know, do the derivation and say, okay, what inferences can be drawn from this, and what does this mean for, you know, for research or for redesigning? I had this with Bob when I was the first one in NIDS, and I had suggested to him that we do not just this, but in the various things that we ought to make observations in areas that were of interest and not institutionally create boxes. But being an engineer, the first thing he did is step up and say, well, this is near-death experience, this is UFOs, these are blah, 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 blah. You know, and there's a great, particularly with engineers, tendency to do that. You can't fault them for it because this is the way they classically address problems. I'm also suggesting here that is the problem, is that we delineate very quickly what's in, what's out, and how do you approach these things. And again, what I think we need to do is to, you know, take off the parameters and look at it from a fresh perspective and see where that leads us. I do think, you know, my bias, again, is that one of the common factors is going to be human consciousness, even in areas where we're seeing the existence of, you know, physical phenomena.
Yeah. Well, again, though, the problem, in a sense, is, like, who's the we? You know what I mean? It's like it's hard to get anyone to – it's hard in general just to get – just to sort of, like, get an organized attack on this thing. So it's – that's, I think, the challenge in a big way for this. Because, like you said, looking at it from the government perspective, it's like there's no one in charge. And that's the same you can say for just about any real, like, paranormal field in general. There's really nobody in charge. It's like the National Cancer Institute or whatever, you know, wherever the groups are. To tie it back to the earlier part about how these phenomena are as complex as those diseases. Like, those diseases have institutions devoted to try to figure it out. You know what I mean?
Well, and that's interesting. And, you know, the last two chapters of the book is where I discuss the flame and then the integration issues. And I do see that as a problem. One of it is, I have done estimations, and others tend to agree, that on a global basis, the amount of money involved in the research for all of these topics is probably around $10 million a year. Let me compare that just a fact for in the U.S. alone, we're doing about $125 billion a year just in cancer. So you can tell we're talking very, very small amounts coming from usually individual donors. Thus, the people doing the research, are very jealous about protecting donors and not an area in which you're going to go out and, spread the information and whatnot, information power.
Right.
Unfortunately, that's the antithesis of what needs to be done because we need macro-integrated studies on these areas. And yet, it's, the classic follow the money, therein lies a good bit of the problem. This is one of the things I point out. From a mechanistic viewpoint, we've spent about $17 billion on the Large Hadron Collider trying to determine what is the God particle. Came up with Higgs boson. Pretty shortly thereafter, we found out there were pentaquarks that were below that. But it's all materialistic driven. And we're prepared to do that, even though the real interest in that would be, for a few theoretical physicists. But we take these other issues, such as continuation of consciousness beyond bodily death. I have not gotten into that much. But it impacts 100% of the population.
Yeah.
So you do not find a high correlation between need and where we commit resources.
Yeah, and it's crazy in a sense because, I know we're coming up on the end here, but it's worth noting. You did a lot of research into healers and stuff, and it's just like it's crazy in a sense just the disparity. if they're spending that much money, like $125 billion on cancer research, it's like wouldn't the smart thing to do just like take a million and look at the look at some of these things? It's kind of like you don't need a lot of funding, really, until you find, something worth pursuing in this stuff. It's crazy.
It is.
It really is. It's really like makes you wonder, if it's just this systematic institutionalization or something, where it's just like they don't want this. If they spend $125 billion on it, they don't want to find the answer to this, right?
Well,
like in a cut and dry way, maybe.
Just this part of the issue is, again, the materialistic world, allopathy. A little over a century ago, they split between homeopathy and allopathic medicine was about 50-50, and the problem became who was funding the medical schools. And they were prepared to do that, provided you taught things that says you're going to need drugs that I'm going to sell to you.
Yeah.
And hence we've gone down that. It wasn't a few decades ago we briefly had NIH take over and come up with alternative medicine, but even that is very, very small by comparison to other forms of medicine. And it's the fundamental difference is in the West in particular, an intense belief in the materialistic world. One of the things we haven't hit, but I think is really a critical issue, and it's one that I stress in the book, is the spirit world. Throughout the areas that I've visited, the notion of a spirit world is, very, very widespread, commonly accepted, and literally essential to what you're doing. In the West, if there is a spirit world and a real world, they are separate and distinct, if you even accept the possibility of a spirit world. I use Brazil as a classic example because there are people who, the ones that I've dealt with, who are highly educated in Western education systems and yet can integrate that with the various forms of spiritist religions because it works.
Yeah. Well, hopefully someday we'll get over this collective social block that I lamented at the beginning of the conversation and really, you know, I don't know, civilization will open its mind again to these ideas. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, John. I loved this interview, and there was so much more. There is so much more in the book that people are going to want to check out that we didn't even get a chance to talk about here on the show. I found the whole thing about telepathic communications with dolphins and whales to be just tremendous stuff, and stuff about healing and healers and hot coals and remote viewing, and a whole third of the book is on sort of the spirit world stuff. So people really want to pick this up. It's a fantastic book, and it's the kind of thing like you read and it's like, you know, each story makes you just wonder about. Oh yeah, we didn't get a chance to talk about the death touch. I was gonna ask you about the death touch. Yes, that's in the book as well, folks. So yeah, there's just a wealth of stories in here that are truly truly mind bending and really make you think. You know, that the world is a lot more fantastic than even I imagined. And I've been talking about this stuff for over a decade. So. I can't thank you enough. I wish we'd gotten you on the show earlier, but I'm glad we managed to get it done tonight. So thank you again, sir, and have a great night.
Well, thank you. Hope you're not inundated.
I'm okay for now. We'll see what happens next week. We're supposed to get another storm next week. We got 2 feet yesterday or a couple days ago, so it's been crazy. But thanks again, and have a great night.
Well, thank you.
There you go, folks. That was Colonel John Alexander. The book is Reality Denied, First-Hand Experiences with Things That Can't Happen But Did. Absolutely fantastic stuff. It's from the folks at Anomalist Books, and I want to mention them especially because over the years, Patrick Weege and the folks at Anomalist were huge, huge, huge supporters of Banal of America. They really were one of the first sites to put us on the map. And so, you know, They were just generous supporters of the show and put us over all the time and sent us books all the time. And in turn, of course, then we had a number of the authors from the Anomalous Books catalog on the show over the years. And some of our best, greatest guests came via the folks at Anomalous. Thinking about perhaps most noteworthy is Adam Davies. Adam Davies wrote a book with Anomalous to Books, and that's what put him on the map for me. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say. You know, we've become just super tight. And as, I mean, his stamp on the show is indelible with the legendary portal story. So, yeah, I wanted to take a moment there and put over Anomalous Books because they are huge, huge backers. I was going to say huge guys. I don't even know what that means. They're huge, huge backers of Banal America. And Daily Grail also. They were the other site that really supported us in a huge way. Greg Taylor of Daily Grail. I've tried to get Greg Taylor on the show in the past, and he's a modest, shy man. Apparently, he will not come on the show. But I've talked to him, so it's not like he doesn't like me or something. We're good friends, so it's just like, come on, man. But yeah, Daily Grail and Anomalous. We always were popping up on there when we first started and really gave us a big boost. So thank you to those guys. What was I going to say? Oh, so somebody on Twitter was like today, is this the last show? It's like, dude, no. Like, you'll know when the last show is, man. But I don't know when the last show is, so there's no way that you'll know. Our original plan for the finale went off the rails, so so we have a backup plan, and I'm in the process of working out the logistics of it. So if I were to tell you a end date, like a sort of I don't know, a predicted time frame, I would say like the end of April, maybe like the first week of May, but we'll see what happens. It's been a crazy,
this has been like a crazy landing here through the end, and it's partially in a sense too, just because of like it's just been this crazy year. It seemed like everything got thrown off with the double episode and messed me all up, and then you know just as we sort of started getting things back up again to wind down the show, I just got slammed by this crazy storm last week that knocked the power out here for 4 days, folks. It was out Thursday morning, and it didn't come back until Sunday at noon. And it was like, as I said at the beginning of the show here with John, it was actually kind of a transcendent experience. I wouldn't recommend it to people, but it was certainly like, it was like a journey into madness. I was describing it to somebody. I described it as like temporary insanity, because you're always sort of like in the now, and you're waiting for the power to come back, and it's just, and you sort of slowly kind of go a little crazy, and you get frustrated and like really mad, and you're like, it's like the expression, not like sensory overload. It's like sensory, whatever the opposite of sensory overload is, you know, it's like sensory deprivation. It's like sensory deprivation. It's like next thing you know, all you've got is your phone. And even though it's funny, when you have power and everything, it's like you can do all kinds of stuff with your phone. But when it's like the only thing you have, it's like really, it's not as great as it seems. yeah. So I don't even know what got me off on that tangent, but I wanted to tell people about that. So, yeah, we will we'll have a show. We should have a show next week. Hopefully I'm not too thrown off here by this Thursday night scheduling. Kind of wiped me out a little bit, to be honest with you. It was like I'm usually kind of fresh by the start of the week. By the end of the week, everybody's just kind of like, all right, let's just get to the weekend. So, but I think I held my own there with John because I had a lot of interesting things that I noticed in the book that I wanted to talk to him about, and I was glad he delved into it, and glad we covered a whole bunch of different stuff because I didn't want to just focus. I could have tried to wring more info out on the Bigelow stuff or on the spoon bending or any of the topics. We could have covered each one of the sort of tentpole topics tonight as a whole show. So I'm glad we got to do a whole bunch of different topics. Again, with regards to next week, I'd say I'd like to do a show on Tuesday, but it's already Thursday now, so it's possible but unlikely. But I'll also say that you know, with like a month left or so of the show, I would expect us to almost go back to the super classic edition style of Banal of America, where we're just gonna. You know, maybe next week we'll do a show on Wednesday, or, you know, the week after that we'll do a show on Saturday morning. You know, it's just going to be a little bit crazy, I think, as we things down here, you know, and interview the last few guests of the season in the series for now. And I guess on that note, I could keep rambling, but who wants to listen to that? Thank you all for listening. Thanks to the folks in the chat room. Thanks to Colonel John Alexander. Once again, the book is Reality Denied, First-Hand Experiences with Things That Can't Happen But Did. It's from Anomalous Books. Punch it into the Amazon. You'll be able to grab it, folks. That's it. So until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.